Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, deciding to wind down his existential trip with the Traveler.
Why would you ever want that trip to end?
Well, you know what, Cam? Just at a certain point, you can only visit so many places where no one's gone before and feel like you've got the universe in the palm of your hand.
I feel like a trip with the Traveler is like the vacation you keep trying to relive, though. The older you get, you keep trying to go back and do the exact same thing, hoping to capture that same experience.
And it's always disappointing.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
fair
right.
Enough.
Speaking of disappointing, let's talk about TNG's lost years.
Whatever do we mean by TNG's lost years, Cam?
Well, there's some big jumps in time when we look at TNG from the transition from All Good Things into the movies and, you know, the subsequent time in between each movie. And there's a lot of unanswered questions, you know, character developments that happen in like these leaps between time.
It's if you look at the timeline between when the first movie came out and when the last one came out, it's essentially an entirely like the same number of years would have passed by that you could do like an entirely new series of adventures. So you have to believe they were having some good times, adventures that could have made it onto TV if the writers felt so inclined and the actors felt so inclined.
They were given some speeches.
Oh, I'm sure. It just
the lost speeches. That should be the next podcast episode.
So much pontificating. Yeah. So, look, let's just jump right into it. Let's talk about some adventures that we're positive that the crew must have had. And maybe we can float some other ones out there.
Sure.
That's, who knows, maybe we're just having a little bit of fun here. But we'll debate about whether or not these would be worth kind of an episode if, you know, fans would like it, if the writers would get enough out of it, if the actors could really sink their teeth into some certain adventures here. Can I throw it out to you? Would you like to begin, Cameron?
Sure. Well, why don't we talk about one that I think, you know, a lot of fans want a little bit of a clarification on, which is what happened with Worf and Deanna Troi?
Okay. That truly bothered me when I was watching Generations. And that there was zero acknowledgement of that, but you still had enough time between All Good Things and Generations that half the crew got new uniforms,
right?
And everybody got new comm badges. Yeah. That could be an episode in and of itself,
sure.
Right there, you know.
Edge of your seat entertainment.
So I'm like, okay, well, you know what? Look, it's go in movies. You can't have time to really acknowledge these relationships. But I really did think Worf and Deanna were going somewhere by the end of the series. They were even talking about it in All Good Things with regards to Riker and Worf had that falling out.
Yeah, like that's a really big part of that extended episode is Riker having to deal with Troi being with Worf.
Yeah, so I was like, okay, well, it's not happening in Generations, but no worries. Worf's coming back for Way of the Warrior. They've got to address it at some point.
Even just a line.
Not even a line, Cam. Never acknowledged ever again after All Good Things. And that was probably, what, a 7-8 episode run of those two as a couple?
Yeah.
And it wasn't like they acknowledged it like all the time, but it was weird that it just disappeared in the ether with no explanation.
Like, was this just a nothing relationship for both of them?
I think it is, like, just kind of a fling. Was that just all, like, hey, that was fun, on to the next thing? Because we all know that, like, it's Troi and Riker meant to be, right?
Yeah, oh, for sure. I mean, it's funny, when you go to Memory Alpha and you look at the timeline of Worf, you know, it's in 2370s when they get together. And then 2371, it says they split amicably. And it's like, well, we never actually saw this. I assume they're, you know, inferring this based on the fact the characters still seem to get along and that's the time period of when their next experience together is.
Yeah.
But the fact that that split is never even seen or acknowledged is really weird.
Do you think that they split amicably or everything that was dealing with their relationship was all off screen and it was a real
it was
brutal
awful.
Breakup?
It split that Enterprise in half. Which side did Picard take?
I think he was on the Troi side.
Who was on Worf's side?
Well, who do you think was behind the breakup? That's what you... What do you think would be the main issue? If I look at Worf's history, this guy's always got a stick up his butt about something within a relationship. I place the blame on Worf in this situation.
For sure. I think Deanna's the one that ends it, though.
Okay.
I think she's the one that, like, Worf, this is a bad decision. We are not well suited. Good luck. Have fun.
But is it even...
You'll always be my treasured friend.
I wonder if it's even that. I think this is kind of the 24th century equivalent of a text breakup.
Ooh,
like,
okay.
Hey, we've gone on...
Deanna sends Data to deliver the news. That's an episode I would watch.
But it's in... he's able to do her voice.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
But it's like kind of... they've only gone on maybe 3 dates or something like that. So it's like, do you really have to get together and hang out in 10 forward awkwardly and lay it out there? I don't know, maybe.
If you're dating on the Enterprise, isn't it like you're always dating your coworker at work?
Yeah.
That's just weird.
Yeah, they've got to see each other on the bridge every single day.
Like, dating a coworker is tense enough. Anyone who's experienced that knows, like, it can be really uncomfortable. Now, imagine you never leave your job.
Yeah. Wait. Oh, podcast is different from from being in working environment. I get what you're saying now, Cam. Okay.
Right.
Do you think anybody in the bridge crew in the main cast sides with Worf in this situation?
What do you think of O'Brien?
Of O'Brien?
Yeah.
He's the one
that strikes me as maybe siding with Worf. He has a little bit of that kind of
every man kind of,
yeah, not a little bit outdated.
A little outdated. Yeah, we don't want to say, I don't think O'Brien is in any way anti-woman or anything like that, but it's more kind of that Archie, a lighter touch Archie Bunker.
So what, racist?
Sort of against Cardassians.
Well, that's true. Yeah,
so
yeah,
got you there.
Yeah, he's kind of a little bit cantankerous, and he would just... I could see him being more, not necessarily like choosing sides, but a little more maybe understanding Worf a little more.
So at the very least, we agree this would be worth a B storyline.
Oh, yeah.
At least, yeah.
I just think it's so weird that they wouldn't acknowledge, even just a line of dialogue in DS9,
truly,
have Worf just acknowledge at some point.
It truly irked me, like, throughout Worf's subsequent appearances after All Good Things, that this was never acknowledged. Even in... Like, even during Nemesis at the wedding, you know, there was no knowing looks between Riker and Worf or anything like that. So.
Well, it's weird because, you know, Jadzia, of course, is his romantic partner on Deep Space Nine. And we would hear often references to Jadzia's past, you know, boyfriends or flings or whatever. Like, she would often acknowledge, you know, people she'd been attracted to or whatever. And
Captain Baudet.
Captain Baudet, that's the one that always jumps to my mind, but like Worf, there was just no mention of it whatsoever.
But that's such a Worf thing.
That is very true.
Totally buy that.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
So,
Okay.
Well, you know, Cam, I got to ask you this. Okay, when we jump off generations just to a certain degree, there has to be an entire episode surrounding the launch of the brand new Enterprise. You know, we've got the destruction of the Enterprise D.
Right.
There's probably at least a 1 year period. We know this from Way of the Warrior until we've got, you know, until anybody has any new assignments, really, because Worf's hanging out at the monastery, chilling for a little while. What is everybody doing in the meantime between the launch of the Enterprise E and the destruction of the D?
Well, I just assumed they were all having, like, a cocktail party while the Enterprise was built in fast motion, like the end of Beyond.
That's all it took.
That's all it took, yeah. And they all toasted as it was ready to take off.
So, wait, how quickly do you think they got the E, like... commissioned as commissioned as the new Enterprise?
I don't know, because I don't have a good grasp, maybe do you, do of how long it takes in 24th century technology to build a new starship. I know, like, when we look at building vehicles in our time, it can take a long time, but in 24th century, is it like really fast?
Well, based on Star Trek Beyond,
it seems pretty quick.
My guess, though, is they probably had a Sovereign class ship that was like half built, and then they figured, hey, the Enterprise D has just been destroyed, why don't we commission this as the Enterprise E? We've got about a year left to work on it. And that's why Worf has not taken up, you know, his regular spot behind the security tactical console on the Enterprise E by that point. We also have a situation where we get to first contact, and it's not like they're still working out the bugs on the ship,
right,
like we saw on the Enterprise A in the Final Frontier.
Yeah, there was no horrible transporter accidents.
Awkward.
Yeah.
So I would say that it was probably about a year between the destruction of the D and the launch of the E.
So what goes on in that year? Like, what does the crew do?
I think a lot of it's like, okay, well, Picard's doing archaeology.
Sure.
We know Worf is on the monastery, hanging out at the monastery. Do you think Troy is counseling Barclay just a little, based on what we see with the Pathfinder arc in on Voyager?
I mean, it's possible.
Because we know that Barclay ends up back on the Enterprise E for that first contact cameo.
Yeah, I want to get to that a little later. I mean, I could see Troy just doing therapy with maybe Starfleet members, just grounded on Earth or something like that. But that makes sense to me.
Yeah. Do you think...
What is Riker doing to avoid becoming a captain?
I know. Yeah. What is he doing for that 1 year time period? It's like...
Is he maybe teaching recruits?
Yeah, I mean...
Training first officers?
He's back at the academy.
Is that what a lot of them would be doing? Like, would Geordi be in the classroom as well?
I honestly think they've earned enough time for a bit of a sabbatical, which is what Worf was able to do.
Sure.
I think a lot of them are just taking extended time period off. They know that this ship is half built. They're like, look, come back about a year from now. You'll have your old position. Just do whatever you want in the meantime. You've earned it by this point. You guys were... The senior crew of the flagship of the Enterprise. Makes sense to me, but...
Had this crash happened at the end of First Contact, I could see in that year that's when sort of Riker and Troy begin to grow closer together.
Yeah.
But you don't have those sort of sparks in First Contact that you have in Insurrection.
And a lot of it was sparked by what was going on with the Fountain of Youth planet.
But it felt like at that point they were growing a little closer together already.
Oh, but you know what? I could always buy... Troy and Riker rekindling their romance at any given moment throughout the run of the series.
Was it just age that just did it? They were just like, you know what? We're getting older. No one else will put up with us. We're perfect together.
Yeah, they're probably thinking like, well, it's just silly that we're not doing this. Why are we going back and forth? So, okay, so let's say the episode is a bit of a getting the band back together sort of episode. Who do you think Picard has to do the most convincing to jump back aboard the ship?
Oh, that is an excellent question.
You know that Worf's not going anywhere. Yeah. Worf needed a change, and that's what was acknowledged in Way of the Warrior.
Right.
Do you think he needed a change because of the whole...
Let's just go through the cast. Well, why does Worf need a change?
Do you think Worf needed a change because of the Troy relationship?
It just shattered him as a man.
It may have.
And it took him some time to recover. Yeah. I mean, well, are you saying Worf doesn't take things well?
I think he's been known to do that every once in a while.
Okay, well, I mean, that's quite possible. But I'm going through the cast. I think Geordi's on board instantly. Like, I think he would love to work with newer engines. I think that would be exciting to him. Data's there. That's easy. I think Riker's happily at Picard's side.
He said at the end of Generations that he always wanted a shot at the seat. So, do you think anybody needs real convincing?
I mean, Crusher, we haven't mentioned Crusher. She's a bit of a question mark because she disappears in the movies.
Yeah, I know.
I want to know why she became a mute in between the series and the films. But, you know, Crusher's, I don't know. I don't think she really needed probably a lot of urging either.
So I think Nurse Ogawa? Is that the holdout?
Definitely Nurse Ogawa. But the thing is, like, if you look at the DS9 crew and you said, like, what would it take to bring all of them back? I could see a lot of conflict within characters preventing them from going back to Deep Space Nine. Whereas, like, TNG, not really.
So, Cam, would this even hold up as an episode to acknowledge
the adventures?
This would
be a pretty boring episode.
It'd be like, hey, guys, we're getting the band back together. Great.
It would be like Star Trek 3, The Search for Spock, where they're recruiting everyone to go back and save Spock. It's so easy.
Sure.
You know, I think so.
This is not like the Blues Brothers, right?
Definitely not. Less police car crashes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, I want to get to one. You know, you referenced Barclay, and I think Barclay's a really interesting character to bring up because, you know, he's a fan favorite on the show. People really like seeing him, but his appearance in Star Trek First Contact is kind of interesting to me because we find out, like, in according to Memory Alpha, I'm going off of, and this is, I think, backed up in a Voyager episode, in 2371, he went to Jupiter Station to work on the EMH program with Lewis Zimmerman. And so 2 years later, he winds up assigned to the E for the battle.
I think this is non-canon. This is just...
I think this is in the Voyager episode.
I'm pretty sure this is just supposition, but go on.
Okay, but let's just go with it, okay? Because, you know, so then Barclay goes onto the E for the battle with the Borg situation, you know, crash lands and deals with the Cochrane stuff. We see his cameo in that episode, or in that film, I should say. The next year, he goes to the Pathfinder project. So... assuming that Barclay is in this research position beforehand, working on the EMH stuff, what is the story to convince Barclay to go to essentially battle? Like, what justifies taking Barclay out of a research lab, which is perfect for him, to be like, well, you're going to battle against the Borg?
He had no idea he was going to battle against
the Borg. That's true, but, you know, what is the reason that they would take this guy out for a year and then put him back into research?
I'm going by based on what we saw. And
sure.
We saw the crew back together in TNG, and I think that's what they had done to assemble.
Sure.
I know Memory Alpha may say that he was at that research project.
See,
but
I do remember that episode tied with him and Zimmerman, and so I feel like that's probably referenced. Like, I'm not confident enough I need to rewatch that episode, but I think there is background for that.
But, like, them explicitly saying that he left the Enterprise D, he joined the project, and then left that project to go join the Enterprise E, and then he went back to So I if this is true, I think
my... Let's just go with it for the sake of conversation.
Okay, I'm not trying to derail your pitch. Yeah. I do apologize. What convinces him to do that? He's a bit of a guy with neuroses.
Right.
Let's be honest. So I think maybe he didn't quite fit in all that well. And he even said during the Pathfinder arc that he only ever really felt at home on the Enterprise D. So I think that plays a big part with why he's trying to recapture that spark that he once had with the Enterprise D. He goes mm-hmm. back to Enterprise E.
He winds up in a battle.
he lucks out, though, because he ends up on planet Earth as opposed to fighting off the Borg.
For sure.
And I think he realizes, what am I doing? I can just be sitting back at a station doing my research in my own little cubicle, and I could be left alone for the most part.
Is that why he seems so rattled in that first episode, in the episode Pathfinder, where Deanna Troi goes to meet him? Like, he seems to have, regressed.
Well, and that's just it, which is kind of why I wasn't a huge fan of this arc, because mm-hmm. we kind of leave the character... It seems as if the character does grow to a certain degree every little adventure that we see with him. I think he was only in, 4 or 5 episodes.
I think so, yeah.
And to see him regress like that, I'm just like, oh, what... Maybe it just emphasizes what kind of, intense structure he needed within mm-hmm. that framework of the Enterprise D crew. I don't know why he couldn't necessarily get that on the Enterprise E.
Right.
There's no civilians on the E. Maybe that was a big... He needed kind of that mix, that guidance from one Guinan, for example, there.
Right.
Which just wasn't getting. So what about you? What do you think maybe... What was behind this jump in vocations that he had quite frequently, apparently?
I don't know. It's very interesting to me because I look at the Barclay character and he's a genius. You can understand why he would excel in a laboratory situation, as we see in the Pathfinder story. And so it becomes fun then to imagine to me him being placed, in this Jupiter station and then being going back to the Enterprise. What is that journey like for this character who's someone who's so routine oriented? And, is he excited to go back, or is he someone who... Because he did not seem unhappy on the Pathfinder project. He was unhappy in terms of dealing with, the bureaucracy going against the project. Yeah. But he seemed very at home and very comfortable in his, occupation there. Whereas, I don't know that I would say he ever felt that comfortable on the Enterprise. A lot of the episodes were tied to him being involved in things that were really traumatic.
Yeah.
He's a guy who... I think you have to, as you said, very he needs structure, and I think a certain amount of predictability. Everything's unpredictable in the Enterprise.
Yeah.
It's
is it amazing he lasted as long as he did?
I mean, I feel like once he wound up back in time on the Cochrane flight, he's just like, you know what? This is as good as it gets to go out on. I'm ending this career on the Enterprise.
We've discussed this before. How did he get through Starfleet?
Yeah.
You consider consider that traumatizing psychological exam that Wesley and the Benzite had to go through.
Yeah.
Barclay passed that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, how was he not transferring off the Enterprise after the situation in the transporter with those worm things in Realm of Fear?
Maybe Stamets, he was conscripted.
I don't know. I think it's just so
strange.
Do you
think there's an Admiral Barclay storyline in which he's got this higher up uncle who's
that'd be great.
Planting him. I'm putting him on the flagship of the entire Federation of Planets here.
It's so weird because I think in a more realistic setting, someone like Barclay would have been targeted very quickly for get this guy in some of the top labs. This is a great resource we have here. I don't know that he's suited well working under Geordi LaForge on the Enterprise.
No. I don't think Geordi's a great manager either.
No.
Very condescending to people.
Yes, very much so.
Okay. Cam, I think this would be a series of adventures here, but why don't we grab this as kind of one little clump that I'm going to pitch to you.
Mm-hmm.
What was the Enterprise crew up to during the Dominion War? Because we kind of know that insurrection took place in the midst of the Dominion War, and they didn't really acknowledge it so much. I know that it was actually written in early drafts of the script. We do get some acknowledgement in Nemesis with regards to the reference as the Remans were cannon fodder during the Dominion War, and when Shinzen was a great battlefield commander,
okay? Yes,
the 18-year-old battlefield human clone of Picard, commander of Romulan forces. Yeah. Anyway, we do imagine that the E was out there like leading some sort of fleet at a certain point, but then they're off having adventures with the Fountain of Youth, like in the midst of this Dominion War,
which seems very trivial compared. Like, how much resources would the Federation and Starfleet be expending on other sorts of missions during something like the Dominion War?
Is this kind of like how, I don't know, if there's a war going on? Let's say it's World War II right now.
Yeah.
Despite all the Canadian war efforts going on in the European theater, there's probably, I don't know, some missions going on in the Arctic to build a bridge or something like that.
Right.
That's possible.
I mean, okay. I mean, that's always possible in terms of Starfleet, but would they be sending the flagship ship?
I don't think so.
Unless it's so precious to them. The Enterprise is such a icon of hope for them that they're like, we don't want this thing scratched.
Yeah. No, that's a good point.
It's, you know, like their big, everyone look to the Enterprise for guidance. By the way, keep the Enterprise off the front lines.
So do you think they just simply weren't on the front lines, period, or this was just one little excursion? I always pictured this as one little excursion in my
head. I think
that's
the case, too.
Okay, so we kind of got an idea of what the DS9 people were all about. Do you get the sense that maybe the Enterprise was just, like, on the other side of the border, or, like, just nowhere near kind of the DS9 front of the war, so to speak?
Well, what strengths do you think this crew brings to a situation like that? Like,
you know what? I'll tell you. I think it's very much a lot of the diplomatically sensitive missions that they had to go on. And I think there was a lot of that going on throughout this war, where you're dealing with, I don't know, I'm sure they're talking to the Tholians or the Ferengi or keeping trade lines open so that Orion pirates weren't attacking them.
Right.
Like, I think they're involved with maybe a lot of that sort of stuff.
That's quite, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, those don't make for flashy adventures, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, yeah, because Picard is not a battle commander type.
No, but doesn't that seem like the kind of adventures the TNG crew would be up to during the Dominion War versus, like, a Ben Sisko-esque, I'm leading the entire fleet, I'm going to be the spear of the entire fleet into battle here.
I have a question. Do you think, now look, the TNG movies are always going to focus on Picard and how great the TNG crew is, right? But do you think in the world of Starfleet, once the Dominion War wrapped up, Sisko kind of took a little bit of the shine off Picard as like the great Star Trek captain? Because he is the guy who kind of, you know, played a very crucial role in ending the war.
The great Star Trek captain or the great Starfleet captain? Like, do you mean within the context of...
Within the context of the universe of Star Trek, yeah.
Yeah. That's a tough one because I think, okay, there's always been kind of this conflict about what Starfleet really is. Is it like a diplomatic kind of explorer sort of organization, or is it a paramilitary organization? Mm-hmm. I would say for the people that hold up the former as the pinnacle of, you know, Starfleet, mm-hmm. the exploratory diplomatic side, I think that the shine is not off Picard.
Right.
I think more of the paramilitary proponents, like the Admiral Marcuses or the Admiral Pressmans of the group, or the Benjamin Maxwells, they would be like, oh, I like this Sisko kid quite a bit.
Right.
So I think there's two different arguments to be made there.
Wouldn't you just love to know Picard's thoughts on the whole thing? Like, because we see in the in Emissary, his interactions with Sisko are pretty tense.
I'll tell you exactly what Picard's thinking. If I was in command of the space station, there never would have been a war.
Ooh,
I would have made sure diplomacy would have won over everything.
Can you imagine how great a scene between Picard and Gul Dukat would have been?
That would have been pretty damn good.
That would have been so entertaining to watch.
I'd have been all for that.
Yeah.
But okay, let's say they're doing like a hypothetical, season 4 of a brand new Next Generation show that was concurrent with the Dominion War
right.
arc. Would this be, how often would we have Dominion War centric episodes just versus the frequency with which we got them on DS9?
I can't see a lot of Dominion War episodes of TNG, especially if, because the reason they focus so much on DS9 is because Sisko is very much at the forefront of the battle.
Yeah.
Like, that's the dramatic storytelling that I think people really get wrapped up in. If Picard's not doing that sort of stuff, I don't know that there's, 26 episodes a season or however many that you really want to chronicle Picard is up to.
Out of 26, I would imagine maybe 7 or 8 would be,
that makes sense.
Dominion War-centric. And the others would be, just kind of regular TNG adventures. Or maybe, like I said, some of those diplomacy-heavy mm-hmm. sorts of missions that they'd have to go on.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes sense. They're doing the kind of missions the Dirty Dozen type missions.
Sure.
Like the kind of the fun little side missions.
Who's the one driving up a ramp to get over the Nazi fence on a motorbike?
I think we both know that's Picard, judging by the movies.
No, that's a very good point.
Which brings me to my next one that I want to talk about. And this is a theory I have.
Okay.
Okay. So in Generations, we see Picard going up against Sorin. And it's not a good physical fight. We see Picard getting stuck in rocks. We see that, Picard grapples a lot in that movie with mortality and feeling older and, the life not lived and all that sort of stuff. I feel like at this point in time, Picard had a meltdown of a midlife crisis.
Well, I actually put a note in my list of pitches I wanted to give you. And it simply says Picard loosens up.
Sure.
I think there's a storyline. I don't know if it's a meltdown. I think there's more of an explanation.
I think it is, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
So if we look, when we get to first contact, suddenly Picard is ripped.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And then when we get to Nemesis, he's driving dune buggies with the best of them with a big grin on his face.
Yeah.
To me, this is Picard just I'm getting old, but I'm going to live young.
See, I see that as a gradual... change for the character, not like a sudden thing that would have been caused by meltdown.
It was getting stuck in the rocks, Tyler.
Well,
it was that moment.
I think you are correct in looking his. I think his experience during Generations really did fundamentally change the character.
Yeah,
I don't think that it caused him to have a meltdown, but I think it made him.
I'm kind of having fun with this, but yeah.
Oh, okay. But I'm saying he gradually realized he needed to loosen up, and like you said, I think he hit the gym. He's
I'll never get stuck in rocks again.
Or it's I'm going to be young forever.
Yes.
But it also, I think what Kirk said to him with regards to never let them take the captain's seat away from you, mm-hmm. I think that stuck with the character. I really, truly think it did. And it informed his latter decisions. And look, it carries forward with the Fountain of Youth planet and the insurrection where he's having a ball singing Gilbert and Sullivan ditties. And he's dancing a lot.
Yeah, no midlife crisis here.
No. He's staring at hummingbirds.
Yeah.
He's enjoying Data playing hay.
Yeah.
So, and then it really culminates when he's dune buggy racing in Nemesis. I think this is kind of he goes to full throttle action hunk.
Right.
So, and this is... behind the scenes, this is very much Patrick Stewart.
Sure, yeah.
He's got his producer's credit by now. He's been begging the writers ever since season 1 of Next Gen. Picard needs to do a lot more shooting.
Right. Now, here's the question then. Okay, we saw Picard on the series as he aged. He very much was sagging very easily into old age. When Picard is, at the end of All Good Things, going into Generations, he's gracefully going into old age. You totally buy it, right? This character is getting older. Now, then we see suddenly he kind of gets a spark of youth again, where he's suddenly I'm going to be young, I'm going to be in good shape, I'm going to be the action hero kind of guy. Is the crash into old age that much less graceful for Picard? is it an ugly awakening?
I'd have to believe so.
Yeah.
Although, it's 24th century medical technology.
Yeah.
Who really knows what they can do? Yeah. I'm sure there's...
Sure. Well,
yeah.
He's not like Admiral McCoy in Encounter at Farpoint.
But let's say we try to address this in like an episode.
Yeah.
Do you think it takes place in the immediate aftermath of Generations, or do you think there's like an episode sometime down the road where he's really trying to grapple with his own sense of mortality in a way that fundamentally changes who he is as a captain to a certain degree too?
I mean, I think just in terms of the physical change, that's going to happen between Generations and First Contact. As for the attitude, I mean, it makes sense to me that it happens also after Generations, because we see in that film, you know, Kirk, as you said, is saying, never let them take the Enterprise away. A lot of that film is him grappling with the idea of aging and getting older.
Well, and also, his only remaining blood relatives have been...
die in a fire.
Horribly killed in a brutal fire.
Yeah.
So I think that does profoundly impact him. So do you think this episode is kind of
like... think it's more like, I just have to live life?
Yeah. I think so. You know, he's taken a little bit more from Kirk than maybe a lot of fans would have suspected based on subsequent films.
Wouldn't you have loved to have seen that Kirk, though, in that film? Like, you know, Kirk has such a history of that kind of attitude, but in Generations, it's not the best Kirk material.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, had you had that Kirk who's like second star to the sun and straight on till morning kind of swagger, I would buy that, like, Picard really took some lessons from him.
Not his egg recipe when they're...
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Everything in Generations, you're like, it's harder to buy that he would be profoundly changed by this encounter.
Maybe he likes riding horses too?
That horse, yeah, maybe that horse ride just really reawakened, you know, his youth in him.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. All right. What about this? You know, if we're talking about like changes going on with people we between Generations and First Contact, what happened to Geordi? There has to have been an episode dealing with the fact that he gets rid of his visor and goes with the ocular implants.
It was the sequel, The Interface.
Good golly.
Tied back into the interface, and it caused his eyesight to somewhat change, yeah.
Well, we also saw, we'll remember in All Good Things, he started to regain, you can't really regain something you never had, but he did get eyesight through cellular regeneration caused by that anomaly.
Did science
anomaly.
Just come around for him? Is that what it was?
I think he could have had these for a long time.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think science came around. It's like he chose to go with the visor. Like, I do remember there's an episode where they established that he got his first visor when he was like 5.
Right.
So, and I'm sure it looks similar to the one that he had. So he would have been kind of upgrading, much like how we get new frames for our glasses, our lenses, every few years. And we did notice, like, I think there was a slight variation in the design of the visor in, like, early season 1/season 2, and then it was refined just a little bit in latter seasons. I'll say this, though. The reason I think this is, like, a profound sort of story is because there is something about the physical acknowledgement of Geordi being a person with a disability.
Right.
And when you give him the ocular implants, that takes away that distinction,
yeah,
which made him stand out. And I think it makes him less of an icon as well for other people
exactly
that have disabilities.
Say, yeah, yeah.
So
it just as a visual design of a character makes him much less interesting.
So I think it's kind of a bit of a cop-out on the part of the character where it's like, I just want to fit in better by just looking, you know, like this.
Especially that far into the run of the story, you know, the adventures of those characters.
Yeah, like year 9?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously we know, like, LeVar Burton, just, he didn't want to keep acting with that thing on. It was a real pain in the ass.
Right.
So I get why he did it.
It was kind of like the Jennifer Lawrence no blue makeup in X-Men Apocalypse.
that kind of annoyed me because, like, the entire point of the Mystique character was that she was embracing her blue skin until the next movie where Jennifer Lawrence was like, I don't want to put this makeup on anymore.
Right.
So, okay, yeah, I think that's a good comparison there.
Is LeVar Burton the Jennifer Lawrence of that cast?
Just in terms of high profile?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got the Reading Rainbow bunny.
That's
at this
true.
Point.
Yeah.
So maybe we could try to justify this to ourselves. Do you think there's like an alien encounter, or he goes through some sort of anomaly that makes his current visor setup unusable, and that's why he needs to go with the ocular implants? Or do you think it's just completely 100% a fashion statement on the part of Geordi LaForge?
I don't think it's a fashion statement.
Well, what do you think is more of a likely explanation?
We never got like a good sense like what the ocular implants or ocular implants like look through his point of view. Like I always liked how the
We did in First Contact.
Did we?
I'm
totally blanking on it.
We remember he spotted Cochrane drinking booze.
That's right. Yes,
through those.
Yeah.
They look a little better than what his eyesight looked like through the visor.
Right.
I do recall that.
Yeah. Do you think there was perhaps a lost episode where there was some sort of alien intelligence or something like infected his visor and allowed him to see better? And he was like, I want better than this. Like going backwards, I can't deal with it anymore. I'm going to try these ocular implants.
Well, it could have just been explained by All Good Things, where like he actually saw like what we see things.
That's true.
And so he puts in an order and they didn't come around by generations. So they didn't come around by generations, so then he had to just wait a little longer. Yeah. Maybe that's what he was doing during that hiatus between the D and the E. He's just getting his ocular implants.
Yeah, and he was checking the mailbox a lot to see if they'd shown up yet.
I do that all the time with Amazon purchases. Yeah,
all the time.
Like, are they here? No? Oh, okay.
Yeah, they were coming from China, so like the shipping took forever.
Yeah, no kidding. I've had this package I've been waiting for about 3 months now.
I had that too, with a Christmas present that showed up in like February.
Yeah, so yeah. I finally contacted the guy. He's like, oh yeah, looks like I got lost. You want me to send you another one? I'm like, what, I've got to wait another 3 months? It's been six months since I've ordered this item? For listeners, I've gotten really nowhere from this purchase that I made quite some time ago. I'm getting frustrated, if you can't tell.
I dealt with one too. The guy was like, well, you know, it's sent, and according to all my data, it arrived in Canada like a month ago, and it did eventually show up, but it's like, I don't know where it was sitting for like a month and a half.
Wonderful.
Yeah. But maybe that's what happened with Geordi's implants as well.
Yeah, I'd assume so.
I wish that, you know, I would have liked, though, an episode actually talking about the Switch, because I think that would have been a really interesting character episode, because that's a big change for Geordi as a character.
I think like it is,
he's very much defined by that visor. And by the time you get to the movies aren't spending a lot of time on Geordi moments.
Who has more moments, Geordi or Crusher?
Well, Geordi has more, I think, than Crusher.
In that he has some period?
Yeah, Crusher gets like her cameo, and that's about it in, you know, a couple of the movies.
At least you and I can joke about Geordi staring blankly at Data's goodbye in Nemesis.
Yeah.
Do you remember anything that Crusher did in that movie? I can't think of anything.
She's at the wedding, I assume.
She must have been talking a little bit about the blood transfusion that Shinzon needed.
She probably gave, that exposition.
I feel bad for
Bev. It's terrible. It's a really good character, just completely wasted.
Yeah. Okay. So we like the idea of doing a Geordi-centric episode that explains.
I think so, because look how bad an episode like Interface is. Like, there's nothing really compelling that comes out of that episode, but I think you could have had an actually compelling episode about the switch over to the ocular implants.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
So, yeah. Okay, well, I have a question for you, and this is a character I don't hear people bring up a lot in terms of the movies, talking about where this character went, and that's Guinan.
Okay, yeah.
Because, you know, Guinan is such a, I think, often very profound character on the show. Whoopi Goldberg's in a lot of episodes. She's not a, you know, consistent cast member, but she's there a lot. And there's always a sense of comfort having Guinan there in 10 Forward and counseling Picard in a lot of ways. She pops up, of course, in Generations in a hugely important role in the Nexus talking to Picard. And then she disappears, and we see her at the wedding in Nemesis. But, like, what was Guinan doing? Like, do you think Guinan left the ship?
Yes. Because there are no civilians on the Enterprise E.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're going to allow one just to operate a bar.
That would be amazing if they did, though.
Yeah. It'd be worth a laugh.
Yeah.
So I think I think we've discussed this on the show. We've all got that friend who just kind of wanders around in life. They pop in and out of your life occasionally.
Are you talking about a former podcast co-host?
It sounds like that.
Yeah.
But I think that's just what she does. This is just her thing. She's like, hey, I'm going to hang out on this Enterprise ship for 6 years.
Right.
That's that. That was fun. I'm going to go do something else at this point. And then, that kid that I knew. Kid.
Kid.
Troy and Riker.
Is Riker the kid?
No, but you know what? They are kids compared with Guinan.
That's
yeah.
true. Yeah.
And she's at least 500, 600 years old. Right. So, yeah. Yeah, I meant kid. Those kids are getting married. Yeah, I'll pop by. I think that's just it for her. That's just the way that she lives her life. And I think, you know, what they would have needed to do, though, is between generations and Nemesis, we needed to have a check-in episode where she figures into the plot. We catch up with what she's been up to, and because she's not into bartending anymore. So the question is, what is she up to, Cam, if she's not a bartender?
Well, that's... I feel like she's going on some sort of adventures, because the thing is, like, Guinan to me is such a powerful character in ways that we never really got to learn the full nature of her powers. But, like, would this character be entertained being a bartender on an Enterprise for a long time?
I think for her, 6 years was a very long time.
Yeah, like, that's like, okay, I did it. You know, I've done this, you know, gone on this adventure. But, like, then I go, yeah, you're right. Like, what does this character go on to do? Like, I'm so ill-versed in what Guinan's powers are. Like, is she doing traveler-type journeys through the cosmos? Is she capable of that? I don't really know.
I think it's to her benefit that her powers were so ill-defined.
Sure.
You know, that there was this ambiguity, and that we can imagine her pretty much doing anything.
Right.
Where would she go? I mean, look at what we do know is that she bartends. Mm-hmm. She likes visiting pre-warp civilizations and intermingling with the upper crust, you know, characters of that society.
Right.
She likes meeting up with, like, Starfleet captains.
Right.
And that's about all we really know about her, right?
Yeah.
So do you think, I don't know, she could go off on an adventure trying to rebuild Elarian society that had really been, you know, just decimated by the Borg?
Maybe. She tracked down Chris Sarandon from...
Chris Sarandon?
Yeah, the DS9 episode. Rivals.
Oh, okay.
Because he was an Elorian.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So maybe she heads to Deep Space Nine to find him in his brief time there.
I'd be all right with her popping up on DS9.
Yeah.
It's kind of disappointing that she didn't make that appearance
in
Rivals.
Doesn't she seem like a character... Okay, let's say that all these series, these Berman-era Star Trek series, all happen nowadays.
Yeah.
Is Guinan a character who's kind of threading all these series together to a certain degree, popping up on a bunch of them, kind of like Rosario Dawson on all the Marvel TV shows?
I could buy that, even with Voyager in that. I'm sure there's some explanation where you can make...
If she can show up in the Nexus, she can show up in the Delta Quadrant. Yeah.
It also brings up, like, some good character stuff if, like, she's dealing with a Seven of Nine character.
Right.
You know, like, because of the Borg connection.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, like, I think there's a lot there. Now, you know, we saw that she had this very rich... relationship with Picard, right? For her years on the Enterprise. Now, for Guinan, those years on the Enterprise are kind of a blip compared to how long she's been around.
Yeah.
How impactful is this relationship with Picard in the time going forward?
No, because they actually had a relationship before she was ever on the Enterprise.
That's true, yeah.
So, and like, it was
but even still, look how long she's been alive.
But it was all very vague. Yeah. And so we never really got a good understanding. For all I know, they could have known each other for like 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
They never said anything about that. But
yeah.
I mean, it's tough because like pretty much everything's like a blip for her, right?
Right.
So how important, how profound is it? I would have to say she would develop like genuine relationships with people. She is, you know, by her nature of that ilk. And I think... her relationship with, if anyone on the crew, with Picard, I think it remains strong. And I think it is like a completely, as a viewer, I have to be invested in this as a genuine relationship. And I do believe it is strong, regardless of how long her lifespan is.
Now, who among the main TNG cast is the first one off her Christmas list?
I would say Worf.
You think Worf?
I mean,
that makes sense to me.
She introduced him to prune juice. I think that she and Geordi actually, they had a lot of good moments together.
Yeah.
I think she found Data amusing.
Definitely. She taught him comedy.
Yeah, I'm sure nobody ran up a bar tab like Riker.
Yeah.
So.
And plus they had their, you know, sexy back and forths in front of Wesley.
Yeah.
That sounds so weird to say.
You know, I think after Worf, I think the next person would probably be Crusher. I just don't remember very many, if any, moments between those two.
Yeah. Nothing. I'm sure there is a moment or two. but nothing that has sort of the richness of some of the other
the fact that we can't even think of anything.
Yeah. And not like a big showcase moment that really jumps to mind. Yeah. More like kind of brief interaction type stuff.
Okay. Cam, what about this? When we leave off with one Data.
Yeah.
There's a couple data points that I want to bring up here. But we leave off with Data in Generations, and he's just an emotional wreck with regards to that emotion chip. By the time he gets to First Contact, he's able to turn it on and off.
Right.
Did he go by the Daystrom Institute? How did they really come to grips with these horrible problems he was having with his emotion chip? That his positronic brain was just not ready to handle? Or was this mostly just a lot of Counselor Troy sessions that he had to go through? Because this is such a new thing. It wasn't that he was physically, his hardware was physically incapable of doing it. He just did not know how to compute, and that's why he needed maybe some counseling sessions. What do you think is more likely?
Well, I feel like Data could get a grasp on his emotions much faster than like a human being could grapple with this sort of emotional trauma, just because he would be able to compute enough information to essentially balance himself out. It makes sense to me why he's consistently more measured in First Contact versus Generations, where he's like a madman. Plus, I think they just knew, just in terms of the actual real world reality, that they knew audiences couldn't handle a Data like that again.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Do you think that this would fall on Troy, or would this fall on someone else? Not Geordi. Geordi's not the one to talk to about this. But
so I think if it was an episode,
yeah,
it would actually be a Troy and Geordi team up episode. Right. What are we going to do about Data?
Oh, I like. And is that the episode title?
Yes, yes, it is. Yeah, I think it's both of them like saying like the conflict. Like it has to be a hardware issue. No. It's an emotional issue,
right.
And it's about them trying to figure out what the best thing is to do to work with Data. And he's more really, he's more just like a background character throughout the episode. And I like this. We didn't really see many Troy Geordi team ups. I think this would be kind of a fun one to do here.
Yeah, and that there's a bit of a competition between the two.
Is this
to see who can fix Data?
Is this again one of those like hiatus adventures that they have between Generations and the launch of the Enterprise E?
Well, they've got time to kill.
Yeah. Makes
sense. Maybe that's what the two of them were doing, was just trying to figure Data out.
Yeah.
Because they're like, Data, time's ticking down to when we got to launch the E. We got to get you straight by then.
There's a couple other brief, like, just data points that I do want to bring up here and get them all out of the way. But his look between the end of First Contact and the beginning of Insurrection, where he has a quarter of his face blown off with the organic tissue that is melted. Do you think he briefly considered keeping the look? Do you think he...
Kind of like the beard?
Yeah. Or maybe do you think he wanted to get rid of the gold skin and go with something brand new? Or was this a debate in his head about what to do just fashion-wise?
Well, we know that Data likes doing kind of some body modifications because, yeah, the beard, but also the gray
skunk
streak of hair. Yeah. In All Good Things. So I could see him maybe watching, T2 on TV and be like, you know, the half silver face is pretty cool looking.
Or do you think he familiarized himself with one Commander Chakotay and it's just like, I need to get a tattoo? Yeah.
Oh, that's quite possible.
I bet that he had like 14 different looks in that 2-year period between the movies, and he eventually settled on his old look by the time we got to Insurrection.
Do you think if Data exists in like a new series nowadays, that they would have more modifications of this character trying different looks?
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, because it's more... Look, back in the day, they wanted kind of the syndication. They just wanted to be able to make it less disconcerting for viewers when they tuned in week to week and it wasn't necessarily in order. But in this situation, I think they would let him go a little wild with maybe... I'd love to see him with, like, a fro
right.
in 1 week. Like, that would be cool.
Like the one John Lovitz had in High School High where he can't walk
through
the
door. Oh, yeah.
Boy, there's a movie reference no one remembers.
I actually watched that one.
Yeah, I saw it in theaters.
It wasn't very good.
No.
Last data point that I do want to bring up, though, is so we leave him off, much like Reg Barkley, by the time we leave him off in Insurrection, he's regressed significantly.
Yeah.
He kind of seems to be the same old Data by the time we get to Nemesis. So what exactly, is this another Geordi and Troy team up to get him back to his old self?
That is such an excellent question. I mean, to me, I never liked that Data just abandoned kind of the emotions. You know, by the time we get back to Nemesis, he doesn't really have that anymore. And it's like, to me, as you said, regress is the perfect word. It's like, this character is on a journey. We've seen throughout TNG, the series, even though it's not serialized, we see Data's going on a journey of discovery about what it means to be human.
He has a far greater understanding of humanity in the last episode versus the first episode.
Exactly, yeah. And the movies really kind of speed that up to a certain degree, dealing with the emotion shift. So the idea that Data, you know, around Insurrection is just like, at the end of Insurrection, is just like, okay, I'm going back to the way I was. It's like, no, this character would be doing more. Like, I feel like even at a certain point, he might transcend humanity, go beyond it. Like, this character, I don't feel would just go backwards.
Do you think he'd be, I don't know, maybe a little bit of experimenting with, like, cybernetic implants? Like,
maybe, yeah.
He got a little taste of the organic skin, and why not do it, but in a less malevolent sort of setting, you know, versus a Borg assimilation?
Yeah. Like why not? There's no reason stop this character from doing that.
Well, the thing is, I know Piller, who wrote Insurrection, really did not like the idea of the emotion ship.
Sure.
He thought it was a real bad thing that they had put in there. I think Ron Moore said that that's the reason why they kind of wanted to have a moment where he could turn it off. But it was interesting where the Borg Queen figured out how to turn it back on. And they were playing with it. That they were giving him interesting stuff to do with the emotion ship, which I thought was good.
Well, I will say, I'm not the world's biggest fan of the emotion ship because I don't like a lot of the stories that came out of that. And, you know, that again, Generations is a nightmare for Data. But if you're going to introduce it, I think it's a disservice to go backwards.
Yeah.
Because it shows that this character is moving beyond, you know, his original programming. He's improving and improving and improving. So, like, to stop that, to me, even though maybe you don't like the track the character's on, it's a disservice to the character to have him back off of it.
Yeah, I agree.
Because I think the Data character would want to continue.
All right, Cam, another a pitch you've got in mind?
Well, let's just talk about Worf. Because I think Worf is kind of a character I think we talked a lot about when we came up with this podcast idea of, like, what is Worf... Like, how is Worf coming back to the Enterprise all these times for these films? Like, what are the circumstances at play? And, like, what is the red tape they're having to go through to get Worf back?
Well, okay. It was incredibly vague what he was even doing in Nemesis.
Yeah.
There's no real explanation at all. Yeah. I mean, he was there for the wedding, and then he just kept sticking around and sticking around.
Yeah.
I think it also begs the question, look, I buy it with First Contact.
Sure.
They transport him off the ship.
Yeah.
Apparently he's installing defense systems in the Briar's Patch or nearby, and he just wanted to drop by. I think that was what the official explanation was.
Yeah, that's pretty much right, yeah.
And then he's brought back for the wedding in Nemesis. I can kind of buy all the excuses that they give. And the fact that it's supposed to be a propulsive movie... If they brush it off, but
is there any red tape to get Worf?
Like, what do you mean by that?
Like, is there any sort of conflict with, like, just bringing Worf back onto the ship and be like, yep, he's on us for the, you know, he's with us for the adventure. Like, are there other characters who are occupying the jobs that Worf is now taking over?
Oh, okay. I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah. No, because
it's more like people are staffing these positions, like, to suddenly bring Worf in. Like, what happens then?
Yeah, well, here's a guy in a red uniform who all of a sudden is taking over the, you know, tactical console.
Right.
Wait, who's this guy again? What's he doing
here? He was just visiting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is there conflict with, like, say, the new security chiefs?
Yes.
That would be fun.
Like, is Picard having to, like, fill out paperwork just to keep Worf there and, like, reassign people?
I don't...
Is it a headache just to make room for Worf?
No. I think Picard's like, he's standing right there. I got this guy's back. He leaves it to Riker to deal with whatever bureaucracy. You know, that's what the Exo is supposed to
do. Right, yeah.
I think the real question here is we should have been getting some reaction shots from the new security chief, the new tactical officer.
Yeah.
That's what's the real interesting thing is. Because the crew would have had... Like, the missing episodes we got is... what we should have had is, like, a rotating lineup of new security and tactical officers. And,
I like to think it's just one, and the guy keeps losing his seat to Worf. He's like, oh, Worf's here. I'll just be back down in my quarters if you need me.
Well, see, I like the idea more. It's like, it's just this revolving lineup, and Picard's like, yeah, this guy's not cutting it. What, she doesn't know what she's doing. She's no Worf.
Right.
You know, get rid of her there. They only last maybe like one episode, and it's just like a nonstop, endless stream of all these Worf replacements that can never cut it.
But you say that they couldn't cut it. But was Worf that irreplaceable on TNG?
It's just Picard being very particular,
very stubborn.
Yeah,
because we saw that, you know, on the show, like Worf is amazing on Deep Space Nine, but on TNG he wasn't the world's greatest security chief.
He'd get his ass handed to him
all the time.
All the time.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So
and he'd always give suggestions to about what to do in a tactical situation, and Picard would always go no.
Yeah.
So.
Do you think, like, the problem was maybe that Picard got, like, ultra, like, capable security chiefs? He's like, no, I don't need someone making a good argument with me. I need someone who I can just tell to shut up.
Yeah. I think that's why we didn't really get to know any of these security chiefs throughout the movies. They're like, but we needed to get some dirty looks at one point. Like, that would have been great moments for the film.
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't you love to just have a side story, though, of some of these fill-in TNG characters who occupied, you know, the same space with your Picards and your Rikers for periods of time?
Kind of like a Lower Decks episode?
Yeah, yeah. Like, how intimidating was that job for them? You know, taking over from Worf, who's this legend I'm sure that Picard can't shut up about.
Yeah.
Every decision the security chief makes,
he's like,
Picard's like, that's not what Worf would have done. Like,
just how adept are you at the Mechlith? my last security chief, he knew all the moves.
They're in there just like on the holodeck practicing Batleth maneuvers over and over, just trying to get Picard's approval.
Who takes over? Remember Worf had those like lessons, like everybody dressed in the white robes, and
right.
He'd give lessons.
Yeah.
I guess Klingon Tai Chi.
Right.
Does the security chief have to start giving those? And he's just making up moves. He doesn't know what to do.
It's quite possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're in that program battling Skeletor.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that. I think there's a lot of gold to mine with regards to trying to fill in. Yeah, all the senior officer meetings, the guy's always trying to get like a word in edgewise. And they're like, who is she? I don't know. What, you're in the senior crew now, ma'am? What?
What I find funny about TNG is that the cast is so specific in their roles on the ship, and they feel so irreplaceable that the idea of like a post-Nemesis world where Picard is on the Enterprise with Data, but like other crew members, just feels weird to me, because to me it's like those characters were irreplaceable.
Well, think about it. Post-Nemesis, you've got Picard.
Yeah.
You've got Crusher and you've got Geordi. Those are the only ones left.
Yeah.
On the ship at that point.
And B4, but I'm not exactly sure what he's doing.
I don't think he's left on the ship, though.
Yeah.
So it's
you, you don't think they're taking him along with them just for the fun?
No. He's I'm being sincere. He's not a Starfleet officer, so it's
But don't
like,
you think if they'd made another movie, he would have been on the ship?
Yes,
yeah,
he would have.
He would have been.
Oh, yeah. Believe me.
First officer, B4.
Probably. Yeah. But, I mean, it's very much kind of a skeleton TNG crew by the time you get to the end of the series. So I think there would have been kind of maybe fun to like have like some of these new people drop in and try to live up to everything else, all these other crew members, you know, that had just become legendary over their 15 years of service on this ship.
There's like big, like massive portraits of them in the hallways.
Yeah, I love that.
Looking down on all the new recruits.
But and their eyes followed the people as they go down the halls.
It's like the Haunted Mansion in Disneyland.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I'd be down with that. All right. Okay, maybe one more for me, and if we want to do a lightning round of some sort,
sure,
then we can wind up here. But why not an episode about Wesley's return to...
Yeah, we've talked about this in the past, about how there was no resolution given to his whole journey with the Traveler.
He just shows up at the wedding in a Starfleet uniform, where his arc had culminated in him deciding that Starfleet was not for him.
Right.
I think this is a real betrayal of the character. And
it's kind of like the Data emotion chip, yeah.
Yeah, and I kind of wish that we had an adventure to kind of acknowledge, or maybe he could come back and reconcile as to why, after all these amazing adventures with the Traveler over about, you know, 8-9 years, he's back in Starfleet. Why? I don't know.
Which seems weird because, you know, when you're journeying with the Traveler, that's like unstructured. It's just like you're experiencing everything. Why would you want to come back to kind of what I feel like would be a very tough job for someone who's lived like that? Yeah.
Yeah, like what?
Like, do you really want to be doing like basic science missions to random planets? Or you're like, yeah, you know what? This is kind of boring. Like, I was just like traversing the galaxies like the Silver Surfer.
Yeah.
Why do I want to be like working on a well?
Do you think
a mining system?
Do you think it's that, or it's just the emotional connection he had with, you know, fellow Starfleet officers? I think.
Well, I mean,
spending a lot of time with a traveler can't be very interesting.
What are you talking about?
But I think maybe that's what he was yearning for, is just more of those emotional connections.
But how much of the emotional connections, though, just had to do with the fact it was a coming-of-age experience for him on the Enterprise, growing up with sort of these mentor figures all around him? Does he have that, anything approaching that experience going back?
But you know what? If he's spending 7-8 years with the Traveler, believe me, I think he wants any sort of, like, connection to any sort of human being. Like, I think he's just kind of... He's kind of sick of that being his one and only companion.
Mm-hmm.
So I can kind of see him thinking like, yeah, why don't I go? I only have 1 year left in the academy. Why don't I go finish it up? I can teach him a few things.
Sure.
And then I just get to hang out with people. And that's all I really want. Do you think he would be insufferable aboard a starship if all he's doing is explaining every single bit of the galaxy to people as they encounter what they think would be brand new, just amazing discoveries?
It would be pretty unbearable.
Yeah.
Do you think in a post-Nemesis world that Wesley winds up on the Enterprise?
That's a good question. I would say, yeah. I mean, like, Picard probably wants to fill out the ranks to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Who else would he try to get back aboard the Enterprise?
I don't think he's fighting to get Barclay back.
No.
Well, okay. I mean, in a you know, post DS9, O'Brien goes to teach at the academy. Do you think he ever considers trying to get O'Brien back?
No, because I don't think that's where O'Brien's arc takes him.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think of like some of the
Ensign Rose.
Ensign Rose not there. She's probably annihilated by.
Yeah, I guess
the
that's
Dominion.
A good point. Yeah.
It's kind of a thin.
Oh, I got one.
Okay.
He goes and springs Tom Riker out of prison and makes him the first officer.
Oh, yeah. I like that idea.
Yeah.
Frakes
likes it, too. He would have had a paycheck for playing the first officer again.
Okay. I think that's a tough one. I'm just trying to think about who would go in the operations seat.
What role does Wesley Crusher fill?
I put him back at the con.
You think so?
I guess so.
There's no more specialized job he could have at this point?
No, maybe he would better fit in at operations. I think that would actually show like some progress for the character.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Voyager's back because we've got Admiral Janeway giving Picard orders as of Nemesis. So I think that he could probably skim from the Voyager crew. Does he get a 7 of 9 commissioned aboard his ship?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Like, is his replacement for Data?
Sure.
Picard only wants to replace crew members with, like, replicas of former crew members.
Yeah, like, they're archetypes.
Yeah, he's like, I need my outsider character.
Yeah. I need a Vulcan and a tactical officer. What about that Tuvok fella?
Yeah, well, we know that, Marina Sirtis had said that they considered replacing her with Jeri Ryan for Star Trek Nemesis. You know,
I believe that's what they told her as a negotiating.
It's quite possible
tactic.
It's quite possible.
I don't believe that was ever on the table.
Probably not. But let's just go off of that. You know, they would have loved to have had 7 of 9 on the bridge with
Hell
Picard.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
great for ratings and to advertise.
Yeah.
So I could totally see her there as well.
Yeah.
Is Stellar Cartography just coming back alive on that TNG ship?
I'd have to believe so. That was one of my favorite sets. The one that we saw in Star Trek Generations. So that was pretty badass.
Yeah.
I think you and I agreed that Tom and B'Elanna, they're probably not pursuing life aboard a starship.
Right.
But I think Harry Kim would be down. Like,
yeah,
you got to give him at least a promotion to lieutenant at this point, right?
Yeah.
So where would Harry Kim, if Wesley's at the ops console, where's Harry Kim aboard the ship?
That is a tough one.
Is he trying to change things up? Does he say, hey, you know what, my buddy Tom was a real great pilot?
That
I want to see if I
thought.
Can give it a shot.
That was what I was going for. Yeah, I was thinking those Captain Proton experiences really changed him.
Do you think Harry and Wesley would have gotten along well with each other?
I think so.
They're contemporaries.
Yeah, I think actually that would be a pretty good, interesting mash of characters.
Yeah.
I have no problem with that.
Geordi would have a new friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Can you imagine that trio hitting the bar scene on Ryza? It'd be something to watch.
That would be something to watch. I kind of am amused at the prospect of Picard having Chakotay as his first officer. That would be a little...
I think Picard would get frustrated.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Why don't we do just a bit of a lightning round here? Okay. I do one, you do one.
Sure.
Okay. Troy proposes to Riker.
Yeah. You know, that is an episode that actually would have been a lot of fun, I think.
Yeah.
You know, You're Cordially Invited is one of the really fun episodes of Deep Space Nine with the Worf Jadzia wedding. I would love to have seen that on, not a wedding, but like the proposal on TNG. Because I think often the character-based moments were the most fun on TNG. So that would have been so fun to have all the planning. And you would
Loxana would have been in that
episode. Oh, hell yeah. And you would have had some great excuses for scenes where they actually have Beverly and Deanna Troi literally like kind of scheming together.
Yeah.
I think it would have been fun.
Yeah.
This could have been a really entertaining episode. Why the... Well, okay. It didn't happen in the films, obviously. You know, until the films, obviously, they got back together. But man,
there
it
must
would
be
have...
a novel or a...
Oh, I'm sure there is.
A comic.
I'm sure there's multiple novels.
Yeah.
But I mean, it seems like... You know, season 7 of TNG had so many dead spots of bad ideas for episodes. It just seems like things like this would have been a more, I think, entertaining way to just please fans in the final season.
Yeah.
I guess they wanted to leave a certain amount of space, I guess, for the films. I guess. I don't know.
Wow.
I don't know if they cared that much.
I don't think they cared at all.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, why were we getting stories like as you the one you like to always bring up with Worf's, human brother, with Paul Sorvino. Or Interface, episodes like that. Why give us those episodes when we can have a fun one like this?
They're out of gas. I think that's that simple.
And, you have the Loxana appearance in that season with Dart Page, which... I mean, look, I get that episode is really important for the character of Loxana. Not exactly one of the most fun episodes of TNG.
Yeah.
I think this could have been a more fun Loxana episode.
I agree. Yeah. Cam, I don't know if you understand the definition of lightning round.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
But
yeah.
I will throw it back to you.
Well, I just am curious, do you think there was ever another story for Q and Picard?
Actually, that was next on my list.
Yeah, because...
I think the answer is yes, absolutely. Yeah. Even though with all good things, I don't think that's the last Q ever sees of Picard and vice versa.
There is some finality to the all good things of him just kind of fading into the background. But yeah, I have a hard time believing a character like that who has infinite amount of time could just let Picard go like that.
I agree.
Yeah.
One more for me. New transporter chief. We never really got to see like who took over from O'Brien permanently. It was always just a string of like random voices. I think that very much like who replaces Worf, like that could have been a little bit of fun, like getting a permanent transporter chief, because Colomini was in like what, like 80, 90 episodes before he moved over to DS9. That apparently is a very important job aboard the ship. So I would say that there's some fun to mine there with a search for a new transporter chief.
Icheb's new role.
I dig that, yeah.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We'll have videos up this week as well as all sorts of other stuff. So join us over there. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Next week, we are going to do an examination of crossover episodes. This is in which kind of the spinoffs, the different franchises, they actually do like a very on-the-nose crossovers with each other. I think a lot of people may think of, an episode like Relics or, say, Sarek as a crossover. That's not quite what we're going for. And I think once you kind of dive into the episode, you'll get what we're saying here. But I don't think it'd be a spoiler to reveal that an episode like Emissary, in which Picard, we mentioned this one earlier on the episode, Picard and Sisko interact, and we even see the Enterprise featured quite prominently on that one. So we're going to be talking about those kinds of episodes. And there's some really great examples, and even a lot of that we might often not think about as crossovers that actually kind of fit into the definition that you and I are going to be working with.
Right.
This is going to be a fun one. And we're just talking about like how well they work and whether they're worth exploring and what could have been done to fix some of the ones that were more problematic.
Right. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in visor over ocular implants, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in new security chief.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.